Welcome to Take Note. I'm Christine Allen. On Thursday, January 4th at 8 p.m., WPSU-TV will air the PBS documentary Lake of Betrayal about the history of the Kinzua Dam in Warren County, Pennsylvania. When the dam was built in 1965 to curb flooding along the Allegheny River, the U.S. government broke a treaty with the Native American Seneca Nation that George Washington had signed in order to confiscate some 10,000 acres of Seneca land. Whole neighborhoods were burned and flooded to form a reservoir, displacing the Seneca from their homes and forests. My guests today on Take Note are Scott Sackett and Paul Lamont, who co-wrote the PBS documentary Lake of Betrayal. Scott Sackett and Paul Lamont, welcome to Take Note.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris. Thank you.
Your film is a story about the Kinzu or Kinzua Dam. Let's begin with a pronunciation question. Some people in the area say Kinzu and some say Kinzua. Which pronunciation do you prefer and why?
This is Scott. Well, we hear it both ways. And we did a lot of research into the meaning of this word. It's obviously a Seneca word, and it translates very close to fish on a spear. And in the film, we have to describe this, but we think a better way to describe it for viewers is its function. It describes a good place to fish. But we hear it pronounced both ways, and I can't pronounce it in Seneca, so both are acceptable as far as Paul and I are concerned.
So Kinzu or Kinzua was a good place to fish. Was this name given to the area before the dam happened?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Obviously, there was a town that was named Kinzua, the township of Kinzua, but I don't know what area the Seneca, other than along the riverbanks where they used to fish. And they took the name for the dam. Originally, it was called the Allegheny Reservoir and the Allegheny Dam, and they changed it very quickly after that. I think 1966, they called it Kinzua.
Did the government change that?
A U.S. Army Corps of Engineers,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I suppose to some form of consolation or honor to the Seneca Nation, which is very little, very late.
That's our belief. We've had that question. Paul and I have had that question come up in many talks that we give, and we don't know why they changed the name other than we can just speculate that it was a tribute.
A tribute, yeah. This is for either of you to answer. When did the idea come to you to do a documentary about the Kinzua Dam?
This is Paul, and the idea came to me several years ago, back in the late 80s. I was working on a film with a couple of producers out of New York City, and they were doing a film about the land lease negotiations that were taking place in Salamanca, New York at the time, because Salamanca sits on Seneca territory. So the city of Salamanca had been basically renting that land. And in 1990, the 99-year lease was coming due, and so they were renegotiating that lease. And these filmmakers from New York City were in town making a film for PBS. And it was actually one of the first films I ever worked on. It was called Honorable Nations. And I was the sound guy. And we were interviewing a lot of people, obviously. And one of the interviews was talking about the Kinzua Dam. And it stuck in my head. And this goes back to, I think this was 1989 when we were doing the interviews. And so that story kind of stuck in my head for a number of years. I always felt there was a larger story than what we were able to tell in that hour-long film. And so in about 2000, I reinvestigated the story. And then again in 2013, I brought it to Scott for us to take a look at doing. And my thought behind it was really, you know, as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, these stories that I was hearing about the wounds that were inflicted on the Seneca Nation when the Kinzua crisis was taking place, they were very, very powerful stories and emotional stories and very difficult for the Seneca to talk about. And as a storyteller, I was immediately drawn to those stories and to what had taken place in the late 50s and early 60s. So as a filmmaker, it was just a natural attraction to this story and how it was being conveyed to me in that short period of time back in the late 80s.
When Paul broached the subject of doing this film, I had already heard about it as well. But we're both from the Western New York area, and I've spent a lot of time in the Alleghenies, a lot of time camping and hiking and cross-country skiing and bird watching. So I'm familiar with the area. And when I learned about it, I was in my 20s. I was surprised that I had never heard the story before, and it kind of confused me. It kind of left me wondering, why is it that I had never heard the story? Why was it not shared outside the area? And as Paul and I came to learn in talking to people, he had already had some experience interviewing Seneca, but as we got into this film and started hearing these stories, I learned, and Paul was reminded about how deep those wounds were and how uncomfortable people were talking about it. They didn't talk about it. The Seneca didn't talk about it very much. And that was one of the difficulties that the nation understood, is that it wasn't being shared with other generations, the younger generations, of exactly what happened, the legal aspects to this story and how it happened and how the Seneca Nation needs to protect itself going forward. But I was surprised that I had never heard the story before. And so when Paul brought the idea to me, I felt a certain responsibility, knowing it, being a Western New Yorker, that we have to tell this to a national audience. And we were really fortunate that we were able to pull together some proposals and find some funding and be able to bring this to public television.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and this is Paul again. And that's the one thing that really strikes us as we go out and we screen the film and we talk to people and we get questions. And so often people just say, well, I was totally unaware of this. And lots of times, you know, people ask, oh, what are you working on right now? And you tell them, I'm doing this film about Kintsugi. And the first thing they might say is, oh, I know that I go down in the reservoir all the time and I fish. We go down there boating. And we've got a little camp down there. We just love it. It's so beautiful. And my question always then is, do you know the story behind it? And inevitably, the answer is no. So there's really a complete lack of understanding of what really happened at that time.
Well, I can attest to that. I've lived in Pennsylvania quite a long time, and I really didn't know the extent of the story and what drama there was and what conflict there was and how these people were harmed and lost their homes, lost their land. Where do you go to begin to research something like the history of the Kintsugi Dam? What are some of your sources?
Well, one of the first places you Google.
Yes, of course.
You start going.
That's
to
where
the
everything
internet.
Starts nowadays.
That's where everything starts. But we had a tremendous, tremendous resource in the Seneca Nation itself. We were given complete access to their archives, and their archives contained some of the greatest footage that we could ask for. Back in 64, 65, Alan Forbes Jr., who was an anthropologist and filmmaker, went down to Seneca territory to document what was happening. And in the archives of the Seneca Nation, there were something like 17 reels of 16-millimeter film that hadn't literally really been opened in years. And so we had access to all that raw footage. Which was just an amazing resource.
That is stunning footage. And you have, I wondered how you got that. The houses being burned, trees being felled. It's very, very dramatic and kind of terrifying.
Well, it is. And our associate producer, Caleb Abrams, was interning at the archives or at the museum down in Seneca Nation. And he found these things, and he didn't even know what they were. But when we brought him on as a researcher initially, before we promoted him to associate producer, he said, well, listen, I found these things. I'm not quite sure what they are. And when we discovered what they were, we realized we had a real treasure on our hands and a way to really enhance the storytelling capabilities.
Let me jump in. This is Scott Sackett again. You asked about how do you start, and Paul said, well, you start with Google, and we've read a number of books on the subject, and of course there were a lot of primary sources within the Seneca Nation, volumes and volumes of letters and documents and photographs, but we also had to tell a national story, and so our research took us to national archives. We went to Washington. We've got imagery from the Kennedy Library. We found some wonderful stories and imagery in the Northwest at Bonneville that helps to tell the national story of what was going on in dam building across the United States. And then there were small archives. I mean, this is one of the reasons it took more than 3 years. It took us a total of 4.5 years to pull this story together. It's finding those resources and finding the story. So often, I think, from my experience and Paul's experience, our experiences together, people look at documentary films, especially historical ones, and there's maybe the easy assumption that, well, the story's been written somewhere. All you have to do is create a cinematic version of it. Well, obviously, that's not true. Even though there are several books on this subject, it was bringing in the personal stories, bringing in the resources, and finding a way to tell this story, which impacts Western New York and the Seneca Nation and Northwest Pennsylvania, and bring in the national perspective. And that's one of the reasons it just takes so long. And we found some wonderful archival material in Yellow Springs, Ohio, but it takes years to find that little archive that has that resource that just is perfect for the film.
Mm-hmm. Scott, Scott, you said that the Seneca people had been reluctant to talk about this story, too painful for them. You have many Native American voices in your film. What was it like to try and find those people and get them to talk to you?
Wow. You know, Paul, it was a very difficult experience. So Paul and I were there with our cinematographer, Stephen McCarthy, and we have our audio guy, John Davis, and our associate producer, Caleb Abrams. And we were asking people to relive one of the hardest experiences of their lives. We had done pre-interviews, so we knew who was willing to talk and who could convey the ideas fluently, coherently, you know, that would come off well on camera. But to actually sit down and then film it and to hear these stories, they opened up and sometimes they broke down too. And it was really hard. I mean, so I'm sitting back observing and taking notes, and Paul is throwing the questions. And I mean, there were times when, I mean, our eyes were just filled with tears. It was really hard. It's one of the hardest sets of interviews I've ever done.
Yeah, and I think for the Seneca, it was a very, I think Scott may have mentioned this earlier, I think it was a very cathartic experience, because they, for years, kept those feelings inside and didn't discuss it because it was so painful. And now, for the first time, someone was asking these questions, and at first a little bit guarded, perhaps they were, but eventually really opened up because it just felt good getting the story out.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Christine Allen. Our guests today are Scott Sackett and Paul Lamont, co-writers of the PBS documentary Lake of Betrayal, about the history of the Kinzua Dam in Warren County. The documentary airs next Thursday night, January 4th at 8 o'clock on WPSU-TV. The film is largely from the Seneca point of view, but you do point out that as terrible as this dam was for the Seneca, it also did some good, particularly for the city of Pittsburgh.
Well, so Pittsburgh, you know, again, this is based on our research. We're filmmakers. We're not historians, but we did research this film. And again, this is Scott talking. So Pittsburgh, in the very early 20th century, was hit by a number of floods very early in the 20th century. And then in 1936, St. Patrick's Day, it was a national disaster. And that set in motion essentially the plans for a massive flood control effort, specifically for Pittsburgh. But it also changed how the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers operated. Until that point, they really had no interest in flood control. And so their mission essentially changed because what happened in Pittsburgh and the East Coast on St. Patrick's Day and the ensuing days in 1936. And so there were always plans from the very early part of the 20th century to do some sort of flood control up the Allegheny River. And what had been targeted was this area just north of the Pennsylvania-New York state line to put in a reservoir, which would have been the largest control measure for protection of the Pittsburgh area. And so that was in 1936. If we're going to get into the history, what really pushed this forward was a policy of the United States right after the war, 1945 to about 1960. It was a policy known as termination, and the idea was to assimilate all Native Americans. And I mean, we can say they were going to be stripped of their rights, which is essentially what was happening. I think the benevolent point of view was they were going to help them. Help them economically, help them adjust into society. But in that push to strip them of their rights and their lands and make them Americans, at that point, it was fairly easy to say, well, if they're not going to be Indians anymore, if they're not going to be Native Americans, let's just take this land, let's protect Pittsburgh, and let's finish this project for flood control. So flooding always was a problem. And in the end of the film, we're sure to make mention of the fact that in 1972, with Hurricane Agnes, the flood did help, once again, Pittsburgh from flooding. So there were benefits. Now, we'll also point out there were alternative plans. There were alternative plans that could have protected Pittsburgh and saved the Seneca Nation.
And the Seneca took that to court, right? They went to court to try and stop it.
They did go to court to try to stop the dam.
Yes, this is Paul. They did. They took it all the way to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court refused to overturn the lower court's decision, and so the treaty was abrogated and Kinzua Dam moved forward. But it was several years of court battles to get it to the point of the Supreme Court, and they really the Seneca really felt that when Kennedy went to the White House and became president, that they would have an ally in their corner, but because of political favors that were owed at the time, that didn't really happen, unfortunately.
And we should mention that the treaty that was violated dated back to 1794, signed by George Washington.
It's interesting. The U.S. at that time was desperately in need of the support of the Seneca. And the Six Nations. And the Six Nations are the Haudenosaunee. They were across all of New York State, the Mohawk, the Onondaga, the Cayuga, the Seneca, and the Onondaga, I said.
And, you said Onondaga.
Oneida. So they essentially needed the Six Nations not to attack them, not to go to war with them. They essentially wanted peace with the Six Nations. They were having difficulties with other Native tribes out west. And so it was a peace treaty. The U.S. government went to the Six Nations, said, please, we want peace with you. And in return, we are going to recognize your lands forever, forever. And then, in the 20th century, the U.S. government sort of reversed decision and said, well, we're not going to honor that treaty. We're going to take the land. We need the land. We need the land for a reservoir. Now, I know where you're going to go. Go ahead, Paul. Tell them the rest of that story.
I think it's interesting to note that this treaty, it's the only treaty with Native Americans or any Indian tribe or nation that gives land forever to the Native nation for their own use and enjoyment. And that shows up in no other treaties with any Indian nation in the country. So it's a very unique treaty.
And I understand that this was all of the Seneca's land in the state of Pennsylvania. They still have some in New York. Is that correct?
There were two areas of land that were Seneca. There was an interesting... Now, for me, because I like history, we both like history, Paul and I, there was a plot of land that was given to Chief Corn Planter, a Seneca chief. It was given by the state of Pennsylvania in the northern part of Pennsylvania. It was how many acres? 1,500 acres?
Something like that.
Yeah. To him and all of his descendants. And that was completely lost.
Yeah, that was a perpetual land grant is what they called it.
And that was it to honor him because of his commitment to the United States, once again, in the very early years of our country. And he allied himself eventually with the United States, and they did that to honor him. And that land was flooded. The other part of the Seneca territory, the other part was treaty protected. Okay, so the land that was in Pennsylvania was not treaty protected. That was a special land grant given by the state of Pennsylvania, so that was revoked. The other treaty protected land is called the Allegheny Territory, and that is the territory of the Seneca Nation. And factually, one-third of that land was flooded. But in one part of the film, we make mention of the fact that even though it was one-third, it was the majority, it was almost two-thirds of what was usable land. What was left was mountaintops. So if you wanted to do any kind of farming, that farmland all became flooded. So that deprived them of the medicinal plants along the water, the wild plants along the water, the best soil for farming. So even though it was technically a third, it was the best land.
Yes, and if you think about that in terms of culture, then when you remove people from the river, they've always called themselves river people. And you remove them from the river, culturally, you're taking something away from them now. And as Scott says, you're taking away the medicines, the herbs, the best farmlands. So it's one way of removing them a step or two further from their culture, which again comes back to this notion of termination, which was taking place at the time.
There are a couple of specific things in the film that I wanted to ask you about. One juxtaposition of images was so striking and memorable, the steps. You have a video of someone walking up steps into a building, and then you have those same steps by the water covered in moss, no building there anymore. Can you tell me that story?
Yeah, this is Paul. We were interviewing Brenda Deegan at the time, and she was telling us about the steps that are still there. And we all just kind of agreed that this would be an excellent visual, a powerful visual. So we knew where the steps were. We had heard about the steps. And so she took us out there one day to talk about what had happened when she was a child, and to get that visual of the steps and that juxtaposition, as you say, I mean, suddenly it brings it home of life, of vibrancy, of community in the archival footage. And then to see the juxtaposition of that image with the image of the steps abandoned, moss covered, weed covered, it's a striking comparison.
How did you find the archival footage?
That, again, was part of the footage that was shot by Alan Forbes Jr., the anthropologist filmmaker that was down there around 64, 65 to document what was happening to the Seneca.
And Johnny Cash actually wrote a song about the building of the Kinzuit Dam, which appears in your film. Tell us about that.
Johnny Cash recorded the song. The song was actually written by a Native American singer-songwriter, folk singer of the time.
Okay.
His name was Peter LaFarge. And Johnny Cash recorded that song for an album he made that was called Bitter Tears. The album contained all music that related to Native American issues that were happening at the time. And this song, As Long as the Grass Shall Grow, was, again, a Peter LaFarge song that he recorded, and it almost became an anthem for the Seneca Nation. In fact, I believe Johnny Cash was named an honorary Seneca after Bitter Tears came out.
Yeah, I think he was adopted by one of the clan mothers. They were very moved by what he had done. And as we've heard the story told, that he had a fond affection and he would go and visit. So, yeah, I think it was a big honor to be adopted into the Seneca clan family.
And there were some non-Native people as well who lost their homes in the building of the reservoir and the dam. How did you find them?
We had several advisors working with us on this film, one of whom is Seneca. He is the former head of the Department of Sociology at St. Bonaventure University. He's retired now. His name is Randy John. And he was doing research to write about the non-Seneca story. So he was part of our project, and he basically suggested, in fact, we met him in Warren, Pennsylvania, on an evening when it was a gathering of folks who had been removed, who had lost their homes and their communities had been destroyed and burned down. And he kind of advised us that there might be something there as part of the film. And I will say that, you know, we're telling the story of Kinzuit Dam and what had happened. And so we felt obligated, of course, to tell the full story. What happened to the Seneca Nation and what happened to everyone else who lived there. And it was very difficult to bring that story in some ways. But Chris, you've seen the film.
Yes.
And so you've seen the finished product. And we're very pleased that we were able to get that story in. But it was not easy to do because there are similarities. And that's what I think was really kind of driving us. We want to show on a very human level. It doesn't matter what your cultural background is. When the government comes and takes your land and burns your house down, that can leave some really deep wounds, regardless. As U.S. citizens, we don't have those rights. By eminent domain, the U.S. government can come in and take our land. And those folks were forced out of their communities. Their communities were destroyed. The assessment values, I guess they are legally correct, but they were left without homes, without communities, and very little money to pay for their moving costs and new homes. And once again, we heard over and over again, which doesn't come out in the story, a lot of those farmers, there were farmers down there, they lost the best farming land, and they were driven away from the best farming land and those flood regions. I mean, that's one of the reasons the flooded plains are so good for growing. It's that flooding process. And so they mostly dispersed, although they get together every year for reunions. The town of Kinzua gets together for a reunion. The village of Corridon and the great folks from the village of Corridon who invite us every year to join them.
Oh,
we've been going now for like 3 or 4
great.
Years. Yeah. Ah. So we filmed them, and they helped to tell that part of the greater story.
For either of you to answer, and both of you to answer, really, how has producing Lake of Betrayal impacted you on a personal level?
This is Paul, and you're absolutely right. You know, you work on a project, and you get so personally and emotionally invested into it that it does change you on some level. For me, I think being within the Seneca Nation and understanding the cultural values that they place on things, the intrinsic value to the human spirit of land, I feel like I've been changed for the better, obviously, just understanding the cultural aspect of how they live their life. And I think we can say that about whether it's with the Seneca Nation, whether it's with a whatever group of people. If we get to know each other's differences and strengths and appreciate what everyone brings to the table, it'll change everyone. And I've been enriched personally just by being immersed within the Seneca Nation and within this story of Kinzua.
This is Scott. I think what makes it maybe different for Paul and me is our approach to filmmaking. Paul and I were privileged to be allowed into, to be welcomed into the Seneca Nation. We were privileged to be welcomed into the Corridon community. We were privileged to be welcomed into Warren, where we've done research, where we've shown the film. And to develop those relationships, to get those personal stories, to spend so much time, yeah, it does affect you. It's not just a job. It's one of the reasons we enjoy our work so much, is it's such a privilege to get that experience. Understanding the story and trying to tell it from their perspective, it was important for us to allow them to tell their story. And this was a very, very difficult story to tell. It's very complex. And there was a huge pitfall to just sort of say, oh, this is another victim story. The Seneca Nation was the victim. Once again, they're losing their land. They're being burned out. We wanted to tell a bigger story than that. And I think anyone who sees the film will walk away probably with some really good questions. We don't try to give answers. We try to leave viewers with really good questions. How is this relevant to today? What's going on today? We can learn so much about who we are and where we're going from history.
And we're out of time. Scott Sackett and Paul Lamont, thank you so much.
Thank you,
thanks,
Chris.
Scott Sackett and Paul Lamont are co-writers of the PBS documentary Lake of Betrayal about the history of the Kinzua Dam in Warren County. You can see that documentary next Thursday night, January 4th at 8 o'clock on WPSU-TV. This is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Christine Allen. To hear other episodes in the Take Note series, check the link on our website, wpsu.org/takenote.